isn't something that I could recall having experienced as a reader. And I myself didn't know what it would be like. So a certain long stretch of the composition of the book was, for me, was erecting a framework that would allow that to happen in considerable detail. I suppose if I were a more methodical writer, or a completely different kind of human being, I might have tried to write a short story as a sort of architectural model. But I don't think prose works that way. I think prose is sort of more fractal in its nature, and I think that the only way you can find out how that works in a novel is to go ahead and write the novel.
Well, it was great having you on Between the Covers today.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure.
We were talking today to the author William Gibson about his latest book, The Peripheral. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
In addition to being weird, Portland is becoming known in the tech industry as a city that fosters innovation. Many people working in the industry believe that new technology can solve problems, including social and environmental problems. Tune in this Friday at 11 a.m. for Disruptive Technologies and Human Design, Part 4 of Startup City, How the New Tech Boom is Changing Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film, presented by the Northwest Film Center. While cinema provides entertainment and escape, for many filmmakers and viewers, it is a vital portal into the lives of others, a medium of engagement, and a powerful tool for social action. Films will be shown from Thursday, October 6th through Wednesday, November 9th, and include the films Familia, Sing Your Song, An African Election, Windfall, and more. Again, that's Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film, presented by the Northwest Film Center, located at the Witzel Auditorium, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information about the films can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is a November 2014 edition of Black Book Talk. Born into slavery in Kentucky and raised on the western frontier of the farm adjacent to Daniel Boone's, rented out as an adolescence to a succession of steamboat captains on the Mississippi and Missouri River, a young man known as Sandy reinvented himself as William Wells Brown. This is Obie Hill, Mirror Image Books.
Patricia Welch, the Library Lady.
And Emma Jackson Ford, Bookwoman.
And we have the privilege of interviewing Ezra Greenspan, who is the author of William Wells Brown, An American, African-American Life. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on the show.
It's good to have you here. We want to tell our listeners that you heard the very beginning of Paul Robeson singing Old Man River, and that seemed appropriate since Brown was born on the Western frontier. More importantly, was essentially sold into slavery to work on a succession of steamboats on the Mississippi and Missouri rivers. So, Mr. Greenspan, tell us a little bit about William Wells Brown. He had an interesting life, to say the least. And how is it that someone from his very humble beginnings recreated himself into a man of letters? And how is he able to do this in the 19th century?
Well, I hope this is a six-hour program. It's a huge question. But let me start by thanking you for that wonderful musical interlude. You might say that Brown's life was at least began as a life on the river. He grew up in Missouri. He worked for a slave trader for a year who plied the slave trade up and down the Mississippi River. He worked on six or seven steamboats. So Brown knew the life of the river. To know the life of the river in the early 19th century meant he knew the life of slavery. And I took that as a touchstone for the story of his life. This was a person born into slavery, a person whose mother and sister, the two people closest to him, were both sold down the river and out of his life. This was from the years they were living in St. Louis in the 1830s. So I saw Brown's life basically as the saga of an entire people. And part of what allowed me to use his experience in that way as a representative life was not just the fact that he'd lived the experience, but that he was arguably one of the most important writers of the experience. So once he became free and literate, he wrote book after book that in various ways, whether in music, in history, in fiction, in drama, told the story of life in slavery and the life thereafter. So it's a saga, and I see it as the saga writ large of African Americans in the 19th century.
But he's best known for Clotel, which is thought of as the first African American novel. And I don't want you to give me every detail, but I do hope in the 30 minutes or less that we have that you can let us know how he leaves his life as an enslaved African American and ends up in Britain writing novels. But I'll just hold off. I can wait for it to unfold, but that's what I am most interested in. But I'm going to turn this over to my co-host Emma to see what she's interested in now. And she's looking at me like, Patricia, as much as you talk, I didn't think you were ready to start. Can you give us a little background on Clotel? Because I think that's what he's most famous for.
Sure. Brown was at the time a fugitive slave. He wrote the novel in London in 1853. He'd been living in Boston from 1847 to 1849. He was a professional anti-slavery lecturer. He was closely linked to William Lloyd Garrison. And he was very successful, both as a writer. He wrote his fugitive slave narrative. He edited the first book of anti-slavery songs by an African-American. But after two very successful years, I think he felt he had to spread his wings. So he went to England in 1849, probably expecting it was an indefinite stay. When the fugitive slave law was passed in 1850, he had no recourse to going back. He was too well known and would have been a likely target for being kidnapped back into slavery. So he stayed in London another 4 years, wrote a number of books, did a number of He was a major anti-slavery lecturer, but we know him best today as the author of the novel that he wrote in 1853, Clotel, which is widely regarded. It probably is the earliest African-American novel. It's also, what may be more important, it's one of the richest. It tells a fictionalized version of a rumor that had been going around. Black folks knew it. A lot of people in the anti-slavery movement had heard it, that Thomas Jefferson had been the father of at least one slave child, an enslaved child by his slave, Sally Hemings. Mm-hmm. Brown believed it and wrote a fictionalized version of what happened to the children of Jefferson as they descended deeper and deeper into slavery, moving from Virginia down into the lower Mississippi Delta, and then lives that basically fanned out across the United States. It's a most amazing story, and as it turns out, this is fairly typical with Brown. It's very difficult to separate fact from fiction. In this case, it's both fact and fiction.
Is there any parallel between Brown's life and the story of Clotel?
Absolutely. When Brown looked in the mirror, he saw what Clotel would have seen. His father had been a white man. His mother was African American. He never knew his father, but he knew who his father was. And so the story of his own life was, in a sense, a reflection of the life of Clotel, and by the way, of many of his best friends, people like Frederick Douglass. You know, it's a fairly common script. White father, enslaved black mother, complicated heritage, but of course, the child followed the lineage of the mother.
He named the father, the slave owner in the story, Thomas Jefferson. Do you think that was because he didn't ever expect to return to the U.S.?
I don't think so. I think he always hoped he would be able to get back to the U.S. When he wrote the novel, it wasn't clear to him, although within a matter of 3 or 4 months, his freedom would be purchased by English supporters and the road back would become possible. But he certainly expected that the novel would be read by Americans, and we know that because he rewrote it 3 more times, and he republished it in somewhat different versions in 1860-61, serialized in the leading black newspaper in the country in New York City, a second time as a dime novel brought out in a series intended in 1864 for Union Army soldiers in the field, and then the third and final time in 1867. So 3 American editions must indicate that Brown had an American audience very much in mind.
This is 515 pages, and there was a lack, according to the information I received, of him leaving behind personal archives or papers that you could use. So you did a masterful job of doing the research. Could you tell how long it took you to do this?
Well, I'd say it took a lifetime of preparation, you know, to understand what one needs to, you know, to deal with in making human lives come alive in any fashion, whether it's one page or 600. But more actually, it was a 5-year project. And I spent 2.5 years freed of my university responsibilities. A lot of that time on the road, because as you're intimating, there was no central archive. You know, whatever library papers Brown once had are gone. So it meant trying to go everywhere, or virtually everywhere that Brown went, lived, every archive that might contain papers relevant to Brown's life, to the lives of the people he knew best, family members, friends, the leading African Americans. So it was a big project. And who's counting 515 pages?
Okay, I was just looking at some information on you, and though certainly you've done work on Brown, it's, and I'm going to read this, and you're going to tell me what this means. Okay. let's see, you're a literary and cultural historian who studies the history of print culture in its various manifestations. You're interested in particular in central activities such as writing, reading, printing, and publishing at institutions, blah, 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 of American print culture. Now, your central figure has long been Walt Whitman, according to this document. And you have an active scholarly interest in cultures of letters of 19th century African Americans. I'm wondering, given the option of studying and developing expertise in a variety of areas, why did you focus on William Wells Brown?
Well, first of all, you just read my scholarly write-up. That's part of my existence. And I guess I try to match that to my more directly human interests. So part of the answer is, from the scholarly side, you know, we have the greatest, in my opinion, the greatest African-American writer of the 19th century, the writer, the pioneer in virtually every genre that we can think of, the writer who tries to rewrite American history in order to make it reflect authentically the lives and the experiences of black people. So for me, professionally, this was a wonderful landscape, as it were, that I wanted to take a voyage through. On a personal level, Brown's life is simply one of the most remarkable American lives that we have. And I found this person born into slavery, probably held illiterate until he escaped at the age of 19, who went on to have this staggeringly interesting, wide-ranging, creative, fertile, successful existence, a matter of just enormous interest to me. But also, I think biographers look for people that they like, that they can relate to. And in many ways, Brown's life is very remote from mine. I'm Jewish, he was Christian, I'm white, he was black. I've grown up in freedom, he was born into slavery. But his life speaks to me. And to devote 5 years to this project was really, for me, a labor of love. So it was a deeply personal and professional project. And, you know, and I'm happy that it came out with the kind of amplitude that it did.
Okay. Can you touch upon the part of his life where he practiced medicine? And also, the other thing I want to hear a little bit about is his temperance, did he march with, I can't even think of her name. Did he march with Salvation Army bands who fought for no drinking? Is that what he did?
He was a little bit earlier than that, but he did it in different ways. But I think that the two parts of your question are interrelated. Basically, Brown did whatever it took. This man was the most remarkable performer. He writes in just about every genre. He practices medicine for 20 years, from 1864 to the end of his life. He was arguably the leading African-American temperance activist during the last 15 years of his life. All of these things for him were ways of promoting the health, the well-being, and the integrity of the African American community. And also for him, because he was basically a high level integrationist, really a way of reforming the entire American community. So he practices medicine in Boston. That's his, apparently, there are no records, so we really know very little about it. But he practiced for 20 years. He must have been successful if he practiced that long. It seems that his clientele, perhaps surprisingly, was at least largely and probably mostly white. But he also, during that same period, I don't know how he did it if he was practicing medicine on a daily basis, was also a very active temperance reformer. A lot of the work he did was in the Boston-Cambridge area in Massachusetts. But he also toured, took larger trips across the North, and in his later years, one of the most interesting developments for a person who had escaped slavery, who had a miserable experience of life in the South, but went back South after 1870 periodically, really sponsored by temperance organizations, but also undoubtedly teaching, distributing literature for the newly literate freedmen of the South, and doing whatever it took to make lives better.
So I'm taking it that in order to practice medicine in those days, you also had to have a license, so that means that you got a medical education?
Right, and there were two ways to a medical education. This was fairly the standard through most of the 19th century. Either one went, as the small minority did, to a medical college and got what we would call a formal higher education in medicine, or, as most people did and as Brown did, one read with a doctor privately. I mean, think of Abe Lincoln as a lawyer. Lincoln didn't go to law school, didn't go to college. He read law privately with an established lawyer. So Brown read privately with someone in Boston. I don't know whom. There were two eminent African-American physicians in Boston, and he might readily have studied with either of them. But on the other hand, Brown had friends across the color line. He might well have studied with a prominent white physician in Boston. But he had been interested in medicine for many years. His master, Dr. John Young, in whose household he grew up as a slave — Young was the first cousin of his biological father — apparently used Brown in Brown's days as a slave to help out with ordinary medical chores around the house. One of his best friends during his 5 years in England was one of England's leading ophthalmologists and surgeons. So Brown had grown up in one fashion or another with medicine in the background, and he would have taken the more common route of reading privately and then putting out a shingle.
Tell me this. Prior to this, being a doctor and writer and lecturer, he did some work with what was known as the Underground Railroad. Was he a conductor, and for how many years did he serve in that capacity?
Well, we don't know exactly. The answer is yes, he was involved in the Underground Railroad. He escaped from a steamboat when his last master, landed in Cincinnati. He ran north. He expected to get to Canada. It was January. The lake was frozen, so he stopped in Cleveland. So that put him really right at the final terminus, as it were, of one of the main routes for fugitive slaves. And we know that Brown almost immediately, 19 years old, poor, with no connections, and certainly against his own well-being, almost immediately started helping runaway slaves get onto steamboats and cross the lake into Canada. And he continued to work for 9 years on steamboats, first from Cleveland, then when they moved from Buffalo. And he claims, probably accurately, that he helped dozens and dozens of runaways cross from the United States into Canada. That crossing was crucial because after 1834, Britain, as part of the British Empire, Canada, as part of the British Empire, no longer allowed slavery within its bounds. So for an African American to cross over, I mean, it was like crossing Lake Erie, was like crossing the River Jordan from slavery into freedom.
I'm reminded of the song Deep River. I'm sure that's all about that.
Yes.
Another question. Okay, obviously Brown was well known during the late 19th century. And then it seems that there was not much known about him, and then suddenly he was rediscovered, for lack of a better word, in late 1960s or 70s. Mm-hmm. How did that, and primarily because of Clotel, how did that come about?
I think a lot of it had to do with the larger shift in American politics and American cultural standards. As you know, it was a byproduct, it was part and parcel of the Civil Rights Movement, that African Americans who had once been prominent, whose culture had once been conspicuous came back into broader visibility and came back in, I think this is really crucial, in positive ways, not as stereotypes, not in derogatory fashion, but it is a positive and eventually as an integral part of the larger American landscape. And Brown was a little bit later than some of his contemporaries to come back. And I think part of the reason for that is that Brown is an extremely difficult writer to understand. His writings do not follow generic formats. His novel is a combination of fiction, of nonfiction. It's got a lot of music in it. It's got a lot of visual scenes. And I think until we came to a more fluid understanding of culture, a greater respect for the performance of culture, of which Brown was a master, I don't think people could easily understand what it was that Brown was trying to do. And I think really only in the last 10 or 15 years, with digital culture, with the common understanding of sampling that was Brown's fundamental literary practice, did Brown's rhythm start to resonate with a broader array of Americans today, black and white. Brown was actually fairly well known in the black community for a long time, but I think even in the African-American community, they knew the name, they respected the reputation, but I think there was a lot of difficulty understanding what it was that Brown was doing that was so unconventional that it seemed somehow, as many people wrote, just bad writing, when in fact it's absolutely brilliant. It's creative, it's original, but it took a long time for Brown to come into perspective.
So how old was Brown when he died, and how did he die?
He died in Cambridge, Massachusetts in 1884, let's say at the age of 70. We don't know for a fact, but it's extremely likely that we're in his bicentennial, that he was born in 1814. He almost certainly died of cancer. In all likelihood, the death certificate says cancer of the bladder, and that's probably the case.
Well, this has really been quite a great experience. Just the research alone is a valuable information, especially to those people who are really interested in this. And I would say that you have done a very, very great job of documentation. Going back to your notes and appendices, this is just, for me, a real great honor to be a part of this interview. We're talking about the book Williams Wells Brown, An African-American Life by Ezra Greenspan. Mr. Greenspan has been talking with us today, and we really appreciate this on this session of Black Book Talk.
And I would be remiss if I didn't say that a copy of this book is in your library system. So if you want to read it, you know, please come in. I don't think there are any holes on it. I checked this morning. But I also want to say, in addition to this, you've also, let me see, you're the editor of William Wells Brown, Clotel and Other Works. And that's came out this year?
It came out this year. And I have to name the publisher because it's important.
That's fine.
It's in the Library of America. And that's a sign, that's the standard publication, edition, of works of great American writing. It's a sign, really, that Brown's time has come. So this was a double project, to tell the story of his life and also to get his writings back into fuller visibility in print.
Okay, well, we thank you for joining us this morning, and we invite our audience to please learn more about William Wells Brown and all of his life and his works.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much for being with us.
This has been Black Book Talk, and we'll see you on that old Swanee River.
Okay. In December.
Yes.
That old man River, he must know. And now for the KBOO News at Noon for Thursday, November 6th, 2014. A man that has been imprisoned in Guantanamo Bay for 13 years was released on Wednesday. Fawzi Al-Awda, a Kuwait national, will remain under watch by the Kuwaiti government when he returns home. Al-Awda is the first Guantanamo prisoner to be released under a new review procedure. It functions like a parole board and assesses how safe it is to release prisoners. The review board said that Al-Awda's minimal training and rank within Al-Qaeda, coupled with familial support and Kuwaiti cooperation, made him safe to release. Al-Awda is the sixth Guantanamo prisoner to be released this year. 148 people remain imprisoned there, 79 of whom are scheduled to be transferred. A police tactic that prevented protesters in Ferguson from standing still has been banned. U.S. District Judge Catherine Perry ruled that police officers could not ask people who were not blocking sidewalks or traffic to move. Judge Perry issued a similar injunction earlier this month against the Missouri Highway Patrol and the St. Louis County Police. Police in Ferguson have imposed a, quote, 5-second rule on protesters. Anyone that is stopped for more than 5 seconds was threatened with arrest. As a result, some protesters in Ferguson have been compelled to march in circles. Protests in Ferguson have persisted since the shooting of Michael Brown, an unarmed black teenager, by a white police officer. A grand jury is expected to rule on whether to pursue charges against the officer in coming weeks. Yesterday, President Obama asked Congress for more than $6 billion in aid to fight Ebola in West Africa and prevent its spread in the United States. $2 billion of that would go to USAID, $2.5 billion would go to the Department of Health and Human Services, and $1.5 billion would remain in an emergency fund. Since it began earlier this year, the West African Ebola epidemic has struggled to gain funding. Last month, the UN